Announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Carle Foundation's Echo Building, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Stephen Greenhouse is the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. He's also the author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. In The Big Squeeze, Greenhouse tells the stories of American workers he's met doing his job. There are stories about people doing all kinds of work under all kinds of conditions. Many of the stories are shocking. Nighttime workers locked into a large retail operation, the crew left without keys to leave the building, the only way out through a fire door. Using a fire exit, even in an emergency, could cost you your job. Greenhouse also makes extensive use of statistics. Here's an example. Worker productivity since 1979 has climbed 60%. He says, quoting here, if wages had kept pace with productivity, the average full-time worker would be earning $58,000 a year. $36,000 was the average in 2007. Greenhouse says we're seeing a broad decline in the status and treatment of American workers. He goes on to say that this trend has made us more vulnerable to life's setbacks, including recession. Many people, even if they have not lost hours, a job, or seen their wages frozen in this downturn, are feeling squeezed. At the same time, he reports that there are companies doing the right thing by their workers and doing well. Stephen Greenhouse is our guest in this portion of the program. We'll talk about what lessening job security, stagnant wages, and declining benefits mean for American workers and the country. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Are you feeling squeezed? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Stephen Greenhouse's book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, is published by Knopf. And again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Stephen Greenhouse, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be here, Celeste.
Well, tell us about those workers in Panama City, Florida, who were locked in for the overnight shift.
Well, those workers work for Sam's Club down in Florida, and I interviewed the shift supervisor, Ferris Cobb. And he said it was kind of bizarre that there'd be, he said there were rats running around at night eating the dog food, and, you know, and they would hear them scampering around and thought this is acutely uncomfortable and they really couldn't leave the building. They were told, you know, they didn't have the keys. There's a fire door, but they were told if they leave the building for any reason, even a medical emergency, they can get fired. The only reason they could use the fire door was a fire. So this shift supervisor I interviewed, Ferris Cobb, told me that one person was, like, deathly sick with food poisoning one night, and he wanted to take him to the hospital, but he was just too scared. He was worried that if he, you know, took the guy out, he, Farris Cobb, could end up getting fired himself. And he called his manager late at night at home, and the manager said, oh, just leave the guy there. Let him take a nap on the mattress, and he'll feel better. Fortunately, you know, the guy survived, but it was not a happy situation.
So why didn't Sam's Club want to lock these workers in?
Well, Sam's, which is part of Walmart, says that it was important to do that to prevent theft and prevent shrinkage. And they also said they did that to protect the store workers from people on the outside, like attacking the store, robbing the store. And, you know, some workers, some Sam's and Walmart workers I interviewed said, well, they're in perfectly safe neighborhoods. It couldn't be true that they locked them in to protect people, you know, to make sure people on the outside did not attack them. I think the real reason they locked them in is they wanted to make sure people did not, you know, go out to McDonald's late at night to get something to eat or did not go out and back to smoke, and, you know, to some degree to prevent theft. But I think it was mainly an efficiency measure to prevent people from, you know, going outside for a break.
Mm. Is that legal?
Unfortunately, it is legal. It's very surprising that it's legal. Mm. Regulations have been interpreted to allow this. You know, some people say there ought to be a law against it.
Yeah. Also in this story, as in a number of other stories in the book, workers were not paid for all the workers they put in on the job. How common is that?
I think it's pretty common. It's hard to get an absolute number, Celeste. But I write about, you know, the huge pressures that, you know, top corporate executives put on middle-level and lower-level managers, you know, to, you know, minimize the amount they spend on labor, to minimize the payroll costs. And the unfortunate result is that lower-level managers engage in all sorts of unpleasant, often illegal things. One of them, as you say, Celeste, is to have employees work off the clock, meaning, let's say you work the 9-to-5 shift, you in theory clock out at 5, and your manager will kind of lean on you and say, we really need you to work an extra hour or two, and you end up doing it unpaid because you want to please your manager. You know, I wrote about this Air Force veteran who worked at a Toys R Us, and one day he sees his manager sitting at a computer and erasing hours that he had worked from his time records. And I found it surprising that managers, you know, were so desperate to cut hours to show their upper-level supervisors how good they're doing in minimizing payroll that they're actually, and this is definitely illegal, they're, you know, subtracting hours of people at work from the time records.
Hmm. Isn't there a cop on the beat?
There aren't enough cops on the beat. Yeah. And the cops there are on the beat really aren't being very vigorous. For better or for worse, over the past generation, the federal government and many state governments have been reducing the number of workforce regulators. A lot of businesses have said, you know, there's too much regulation, there's too much enforcement, and now a lot of workers say there isn't enough enforcement, there isn't enough people stopping off-the-clock work and shaving hours, and, things like the Sago mining disaster where 12 workers got killed in an explosion. And maybe the pendulum is starting to slowly move back.
Yeah. Well, here maybe you should tell us a story about a company that's doing the right thing by its workers and doing well, because I don't want this program to be, just raging against corporate America.
Sure. Let me step back a second.
Sure.
In the book, I try to explain, you know, what is happening in the American workplace. There have been lots of books written about, you know, high-tech whiz kids and about billionaires like Warren Buffett, and there really has been very little written about, you know, what's happening to the nation's 140 million workers. So I write about, I write some about software engineers, I write about janitors, I write about factory workers. Actually, I write a whole bunch about, people in Illinois, a hotel housekeeper in Chicago, workers at Caterpillar in Peoria, the Maytag factory, refrigerator factory in Galesburg that closed. So I have, you know, a lot about how workers are squeezed and you know, some about corporate wrongdoing and what we can learn from all that. But I thought I should also write about, you know, companies that are really doing the right thing, that are really helping their workers. And I write about companies like Costco, a direct competitor of Walmart, and Patagonia, which, you know, do wonderful things in terms of, you know, treating their workers with respect and going the extra mile to help provide work-family balance. You know, Patagonia out in California, you know, does some amazing stuff. It's about 150 yards from the Pacific, and workers are almost encouraged to go surfing at lunchtime, and they can maybe take a two and a half hour lunch break and go surfing, and the company trusts them to do that because it trusts them to get their work done in the evening. And, you know, Patagonia also provides 8 weeks paid maternity leave for new mothers, 8 weeks paid paternity leave. If you adopt a child, it gives you 8 weeks adoption leave. And I cite companies like Patagonia and Costco and Ernst & Young because they really are models, and I think the rest of the nation, the rest of corporate America, can learn from them.
Stephen Greenhouse is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, several comments. One, I think, as the writer mentioned, some aspects of corporate America are really good, but in general, why not rage against corporate America? I think they've done a number of negative things, but my comment, it's a little bit complicated. There's been a number, I haven't seen this author's book, I'd like to read it, but there's been a number of books, The Squandering of America, I can't think of the author's name, Free Lunch, Johnson, and so forth. And so many times when the imbalance for the worker becomes imbalanced, one of the main ways of correcting it is through the ballot box, by electing appropriate senators and so forth. But today, apparently, the Supreme Court is requiring a voter ID, is allowing states to require voter IDs, which is going to disenfranchise a large number of people that vote in terms on the lower economic strata. How, to my mind, this will make it much more difficult to shift the pendulum away from the power of corporate America. I just want to see if he will comment on that. Thank you.
Okay. Stephen Greenhouse?
Yes, sir. I agree that things are out of balance, and I use that phrase a lot in my book. And things are out of balance, and that, you know, companies are not sharing their profits and prosperity as much as they used to. Profits have gone way up, yet wages have been stagnant. And I talked a few minutes ago about too many corporate managers, you know, feeling compelled to break the law to minimize their labor costs. You know, that's another example of things being out of balance. And we've seen these surveys, New York Times, CBS survey, saying that, you know, 81% of Americans think the country is pretty wrong, pretty much off on the wrong track. And you wonder, why aren't more people jumping up and down saying we've got to fix this? And, you know, making it hard for poor Americans, you know, to vote by requiring all sorts of IDs, that will probably make it harder. You know, I, as a reporter for a newspaper, can't, you know, comment one way or the other on what the Supreme Court might or might not do or should or should not do. But, you know, to the extent that any actions disenfranchise lower-income voters, it's going to make it harder to restore balance. I think that's a fair comment that really can't be quarreled with.
And you talk about, you know, we wonder why we aren't jumping up and down and demanding change here. One of the things that you write about very early in The Big Squeeze is this: the decline in the status and treatment of American workers is one of the least examined trends taking place in the United States today, but it is one of the most important. Why is it drawing so little attention?
Several reasons, Celeste. We live in a celebrity culture, for better or for worse. You know, toward the end of the book, I say that, you know, probably Paris Hilton has gotten more ink and more airtime on television than maybe all the nation's workers combined over the past few years. And unfortunately, the news media often sees you know, workers and working problems, you know, stagnant wages, disappearing pensions as not sexy, as not boring. And I think that's one reason there isn't enough attention paid. Second, a lot of news media no longer have reporters writing about labor and workplace matters. You know, I'm one of the very few left in the nation. You know, Steve Franklin of the Chicago Tribune is one of the others. And it's a declining group. And, you know, the fewer people there are writing about workers and workplace problems, the less attention the public will pay to it. And unfortunately, the less attention politicians pay to it. I think, you know, our campaign finance system, which, you know, relies heavily on contributions from wealthy Americans, has politicians, understandably, paying a lot of attention to what the wealthy folks have to say, and arguably less attention to what typical middle-class Americans and workers, you know, paying less attention to their concerns. And another thing I should add to Les is unions have grown much weaker over the past generation. They represent just 7% of private sector workers. In the 1950s, they represented more than 35%. And the fact that unions are much weaker means that there just isn't as strong a voice as there used to be on behalf of the nation's workers, white collar and blue collar, low wage, you know, medium income.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book on unions, the state of the unions. And in this chapter, you say, in candid moments, some labor leaders confess that American unions seem to be sliding toward irrelevance and oblivion. On the other hand, one thinks that there might be some great opportunity for organized labor, given if we're all feeling squeezed.
Yes, Celeste. I write on one hand that, you know, unions have been extremely successful in helping build the nation's middle class. And I write about the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, and, you know, all this took place in the Midwest, you know, that the UAW in the 1940s with General Motors and Ford, you know, got these wonderful contracts with very good wages and very good health benefits and very good pensions, and that was instrumental in helping create the world's largest and richest middle class. You know, then in the 1980s, there was a real surge in import competition, and all of a sudden, you know, steelmakers like Inland Steel and U.S. Steel became vulnerable, and the auto companies became vulnerable, and unions were under attack, and so were the very good wages and benefits. So in ways, you know, unions and the great wages they created were a victim of their own success. Now, unions are much weaker, and I say that, you know, especially for low-wage workers, but also for some middle-wage workers, middle-income workers, unions might help restore some balance. You know, to use the phrase the gentleman caller made earlier, you know, there's an imbalance. Now, for instance, I write about some janitors in Houston who, after 10 years of, you know, cleaning floors and cleaning bathrooms, were still earning just $5.25 an hour, which is, you know, some people I tell that to say, that can't be true.
Yeah.
So these 5,300 janitors in Houston formed a union, and thanks to the union, they got basically a 60% raise over 3 years, and they're getting health insurance. And it's, you know, it's helping turn things around for them.
Are these the janitors that were working 365 days a year?
That was a different group.
A different, okay.
A lot of supermarkets and big retail stores were hiring subcontractors that in turn were hiring janitors who literally worked 365 days a year. Maybe once in a while the boss would be nice and give them Christmas Eve or Christmas night off. So it was only 364 days. And most of these workers were undocumented, and it was all off the books. You know, they wouldn't, you know, the employers wouldn't pay Social Security tax, wouldn't pay workers' comp, wouldn't withhold income taxes, and, you know, American taxpayers were cheated, the workers were cheated, you know, the competitors who wanted to comply with the law, they had a hard time. So, you know, it's very hard to begin to think about unionizing workers like that, you know, where everything's off the books and secretive. You know, the Houston janitors, you know, they were on the books, and, you know, with big, well-known contracting firms. So that made it easier to unionize them.
Yeah. So back to unions and unionizing and organizing. Are some unions managing to adapt to the times?
Some, you know, there are some, you know, good aggressive unions that seem to be turning things around. And, you know, I think of the Service Employees Union, which was the union that organized the janitors in Houston. A union like the California Nurses Association has been very successful organizing nurses. You know, some of the teachers' unions, I know a lot of people criticize teachers' unions, but they've certainly been successful in unionizing workers. In my book, I write at length about, in my chapter on globalization and its effect on American workers, I write at length about Maytag's decision to close its refrigerator factory in Galesburg and the 1,600 workers who were laid off as a result. And that was a unionized plant, the machinist union. And the machinists, you know, tried their darndest to preserve the plant, and it's a good, smart union. But in the face of globalization, many companies are going to close plants. And at the, you know, at the plant in Galesburg, the Maytag workers were making $15.14 an hour, which isn't great, but it's, you know, good enough, you know, to be in the middle class or start being in the middle class. And Maytag closed the plant and moved it to Reynosa, Mexico, where the pay was $1 to $2 an hour. And I interviewed, you know, a worker from Galesburg, Aaron Kemp, who said, you know, this is crazy. They want us to buy, you know, American, you know, Maytag refrigerators, but the people they are hiring to make them aren't American, and the people, the Mexicans who are making those refrigerators, won't even be able to afford to buy the refrigerators they're making.
And a community like Galesburg, this not only squeezes 1,600 individual workers, it squeezes an entire community.
Absolutely, Celeste. There was an estimate that something like 5,000 people from Illinois lost their jobs as a result of this one closing. It's not just the direct factory workers. It's the truckers. It's the, you know, shops nearby that rely on the paychecks of the Maytag workers. And, you know, in my book, I talk about, you know, the downside of global competition, but I also, you know, I try to write fairly about its positive effects as well. It does reduce prices. It helps keep down prices for American consumers. It does create jobs for people in Mexico or India. You know, I think too many discussions of globalization, you know, look at it as all bad or as all good, a win-win for consumers and a win-win for corporations, but it has its advantages and its disadvantages, and I try very hard to look at the pros and the cons. And I also look at it in the context of white-collar workers. In discussing its effect on white-collar workers, I tell this crazy story of a woman who was a software engineer just outside Seattle, Myra Bronstein, who's originally from Kansas City, and she worked at a company that told its workers, as long as we're in business, as long as you work hard, don't worry, you'll have a job. Mm. So Myra often worked 14, 16, 18 hours a day because there's always a rush to get the latest software out the door. And she was a good worker, and she was pretty happy. Then one day the company says, okay, you 18 quality assurance engineers were having a meeting, and they announced that the workers are being laid off. And the workers felt betrayed because they were told, you know, as long as the company's doing okay, they'll have a job. And in ways to add insult to injury, these engineers were told, if you want to receive any severance pay whatsoever, you have to agree to spend the next 4 weeks training the workers from India who will be replacing you. And they all reluctantly agreed, but they felt betrayed and insulted. Mm. And, you know, so that weekend, these 20 engineers were flown in from India. Myra and the other workers trained them for 4 weeks, and then the workers went back to India and had the jobs that Myra and the other engineers used to have. Hmm.
You quote Warren Buffett in the book as saying this: there's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. He also said workers have been on a treadmill while the very rich have been on a spaceship. So if Buffett is right, who built the spaceship, and how was it built?
Good question, Celeste. sometimes I've done one other radio interview, and I read those quotes, and I said, you know, guess who said that? Was it Jesse Jackson? Was it Ralph Nader? Was it, you know, John Edwards? No, it was Warren Buffett, who I guess now is actually the nation's richest man. He's surpassed Bill Gates. And so what has caused the spaceship? Good question. I think there's several forces. One is that, you know, unions are weaker, so there's less pressure on companies to be more generous. You know, CEO pay has, you know, gone into outer space, as we all know. And, you know, for many reasons, there's no longer any, there's very little check on CEO pay. Globalization has had many complicated effects. One of them is it's helped hold down wages for American workers. On the other hand, for companies and corporate executives and investors and shareholders, globalization has enabled many companies to increase their profits because they say, well, should we make these refrigerators in Galesburg for $15-$14 an hour? Hey, look, we could make them in Mexico for a dollar or two an hour. We can make a lot more money there. We can increase our profits. So, you know, moving plants to China or India or Mexico enable companies to make much more money, and that, you know, the investors who own the companies, the top 1%, 2%, 3% benefit. All the while, you know, workers like, you know, Aaron Kemp, who I wrote about in Galesburg, their wages are really squeezed down.
Yeah. Stephen Greenhouse is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. He's also the author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now, a listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi. Interesting discussion. I was curious if the guest had information on what percentage of pay, let's say the top, you know, 10%, like the highest paid employees, get of total payroll for a company versus what it used to be 20 years ago. If you had any data like that, I'd be curious to know.
I'm not sure, in truth, but I recently saw a few statistics. One said that of all the income growth the nation has enjoyed in like over the past 15 years, about half of that has gone to the top 1%. So, you know, that's CEOs, and that's also, you know, the Alex Rodriguez's of the world as well. But, you know, it clearly indicates that the people at the top of corporations are taking more of the income, both the CEOs and the shareholders. Another statistic that's relevant is that back in 1980, you know, the top 1% at the top of the economic pyramid were making 9% of all national income, according to a respected study. Now that's up to 21 or 22%. So that means the other 99% of Americans, you know, there's less of the economic pie for them. I realize I'm not directly answering your question, but I think what I'm saying, you know, is relevant and helps you get a sense.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. A listener in Spring Bay on line four. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Well, I was looking or thinking about Detroit and the auto workers and this parts company. It was last year, I think it was, that went bankrupt or went out of business, Adelphi or something like that. And I'm just thinking in terms of the workers, the guys on the line seem to be the ones that are going to take it on the chin, and the managers who have been making the decisions of what kind of cars they're going to build, continued to build these gas guzzlers, and now it's a product that in the future nobody's going to want. I think the big three are really going to be hard hit, and it seems like the line workers are going to be the guys that are really going to suffer as a result of the decisions made by management. I was just wondering if you could make a comment on that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. You know, clearly over the past 10 or 20 years, the line workers have already been, hit pretty hard. And, you know, some company people, some Wall Street people will say, well, these companies are hit hard because the unions are greedy and these workers are paid too much. And a lot of other people say the main reason Detroit is having this crisis is it's designing such, you know, clunky cars that gets its bad mileage, and that's why people are buying Toyotas and Hondas. And, I think Detroit is slowly, far too slowly, catching on and trying to revamp its designs, you know, to de-emphasize gas guzzlers and to focus more on hybrid cars. But unfortunately, Detroit is far behind the Japanese.
Let's take another call, a listener on a cell phone near Lovington. Line 2, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I agree with you that CEOs are making way too much and are taking way too much of the pie, but I live near Decatur, Illinois, Uniontown. I know a lot of people that work in labor-type jobs. And the unfortunate thing about it is they will not vote for their income. They're like, oh, you know, that guy's going to take away our guns and he's for killing babies. And, you know, they don't seem to have any clue that they can represent themselves in a positive way economically. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
That's a very good question, and it ties into the point I made before that, you know, if 81% of Americans say the country's really off on the wrong track, why aren't they, you know, pushing for huge changes? And you're right, a lot of workers will, you know, not vote in their economic interest. You know, they'll pay more attention to other issues like, abortion rights or guns or religion. And clearly, you know, someone like John Edwards was hoping to change all that, and he had a fervent campaign as an economic populist, you know, increase wages, improve benefits, have universal health coverage. And in theory, someone like that, you know, should have caught on greater, but he didn't, you know, partly because, you know, Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, you know, kind of stole some of his thunder and took some of his message.
Hmm. What are your thoughts about the discussion underway on these issues in the current campaign?
I write in my book that for years Washington has ignored the problems of American workers. I point out that since 2000, the United States has lost 1 in 5 of its manufacturing jobs, 1 in 5 factory jobs. That's like a secret; no one knows about it. And I say only Washington seems to ignore the concerns of workers until each primary season when people are running around Iowa and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin, and then all of a sudden they discover worker issues. And, you know, it's good that, you know, many of the candidates are starting to focus on worker issues because they're seeing how squeezed people are. I mean, it was good that John McCain went to Youngstown, Ohio to see, you know, how battered that town is. And the candidates are starting to articulate some solutions, and that's good. But it would be very hard. Let's hope we could reverse the decline of manufacturing in America, but it's not easy. It will take some serious steps. You know, our health costs are very high, and that makes it very hard for the nation's manufacturers. We have infrastructure problems. Our roads are suffering. Our bridges are suffering. I think that takes its toll on the nation's competitiveness. You know, the dollar is very weak now. That hurts those who travel abroad, but that should help American manufacturers. But I think another area where we're lacking is, you know, American companies aren't investing enough to try to, you know, build new factories and innovate. I think, you know, too often now we're seeing companies say, why should we build a factory in Peoria or Decatur or Galesburg or Chicago? Let's just build it in China. And that's really hurting us as well.
Mm.
Might be good for consumers, but it's hurting us as workers.
Yeah. One of the issues you write about in the book a little bit is about the role of a college education. And here it's getting tougher and tougher for people to get through school without having a huge amount of debt at the end of it all. And you could make the argument, I suspect, that, you know, this is an investment we also need to make. This is a kind of a brain infrastructure investment. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I write a lot about Peoria, Galesburg, in the book, and I write about a young woman, terrific young woman named Melissa Devaney from Peoria, whose parents worked in the cafeteria of a big hospital in Peoria for years. And Melissa wanted to go to college. You know, she was the top 10% of her high school class at in Peoria. And she really couldn't afford to go to the 4-year. She wanted to go to the University of Illinois, a 4-year college, and she couldn't afford it. Her parents said, "I'm sorry, you just can't afford it." So she started at a very good community college, Illinois Central in Peoria, and then she dropped out of community college because she had to make more money. And you know, one interesting statistic I learned about when I was writing the book is that a generation ago, the typical college graduate earned 40% more than the typical high school graduate. Now that gap is, like, the typical college graduate earns about 75% more than the typical high school graduate. So that shows all the more how important it is to get a college degree. Yet, as Melissa's story shows, a lot of American, you know, young Americans and their parents can't afford college, and that's a real problem. I was amazed. I was reading Business Week the other day, and I saw that for this decade, for the first time ever, the percentage of people in their 20s who've graduated from college has declined during the decade. That's never happened before in American history, and that shows that colleges are getting too expensive. At the same time, that the income of many families has remained stagnant. You know, when I talked before about wages in recent years have really remained flat, since 2001, even as productivity has gone up 15%, even as corporate profits have doubled. So a lot of people who want to go to college are just totally squeezed. Their parents can't afford it. A lot of kids borrow and borrow and borrow, and some of them end up dropping out of college because they borrow so much they can't afford it.
Yeah. Stephen Greenhouse, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm Betty Williams, and I wanted to mention something to him and things. You know, he was talking about McCain went someplace and was trying to talk to some people about the condition. McCain is part of the problem. McCain and Hillary is part of the problem because of all of these lobbyists and things. We just sit back and just listen to these people lie back and forth. And here we have Hillary talking about what she going to do, and her husband's getting money from Columbia and things for trying to get trade from there, which will probably be taking away some jobs and things. And people, I just have a high school diploma, and people are more educated than I am, and they act so dumb. I just don't get it, you know, because where Obama is getting his money is from people like me. I had never given a politician any money. I send him $100. And I will send them none because I think we need a change. I want you to speak on that.
Okay.
As I said before, I think the campaign finance system is constructed. A lot of people can give $2,000 to each candidate, and many Americans cannot begin to afford $2,000. So I think in ways the system favors those who can give more. And, whether it's Hillary Clinton or John McCain or Barack Obama, they are all receiving money from some wealthy contributors. You know, clearly the statistics show that Barack Obama is getting more from, small contributors like yourself.
Should we take another call? Listener in Morris now, line four. Hi.
How are you guys doing this afternoon?
Fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with that list earlier. Just called before me, but it's everybody's problem. We have candidates who are running. What is a senator is what six years, right, for a term?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, they're spending half their term running an office. Where are they with their votes? Like, you got Barack Obama, John McCain, and Hillary Clinton right now running that have been running for, what, almost 2 years now, and nothing is getting done. Nothing. So she can't just come on here and say Barack is innocent because he's just as different. If she would look at, I challenge her, look at what Barack Obama has voted on or hasn't voted on. Look at Hillary, same thing, or John McCain. The problem is this country is lacking in a third-party candidate, and until we get it, we're going to be no different. It doesn't matter. Those three people, one of those three people will be elected, and somehow it'll be the same old, same old. We'll be sitting here talking on this station again a year from now, talking about how bad things are and how things are not going anywhere because we'll have the same old people. And, you know, when it comes to college, I'm out of work. I'm looking for a college. I have a 2-year degree in forestry, and guess what I'm doing? Nothing. There is no job for somebody of my age of 51. And that's, honestly, that's probably most people that are between 45 and 55 right now are probably looking, if not looking for a job, or scared, or they might be fired from one, so they'll just stay and do what and take whatever it takes because that's the way our country is going. Am I not right?
Well, it's you know, the nation apparently is entering a recession, and if you're out of work already, you know, the recession is going to make it that much harder to find work. And yes, you're right that it's probably harder when you're 51 to find a job than when you're 26. You know, but on the other hand, you know, there've been all this research showing that a lot of baby boomers are starting to retire, and that there could be a shortage of workers. You know, once we recover from the recession. And that might enable people like you to find jobs. You know, a lot of the job experts say, and I get into this somewhat in the book, say, you know, it's important to have marketable skills. And hopefully there are folks out there, companies out there, government agencies out there that want someone with forestry expertise like yourself. But if you're having a hard time finding a job in forestry, then maybe you have to reskill yourself or take some job training courses, you know, to figure out another field to get work.
Yeah. I suspect, Stephen, in given your beat, that you hear a lot of frustration and a lot of anxiety and a lot of also maybe confusion from people wondering, you know, what's ahead.
Now, absolutely, Celeste. You know, I have a chapter about how in many ways things are tougher for the younger generation, for people just getting out of high school, people just getting out of college, than it was for their parents' generation. And I write at length about two workers from Peoria who work at Caterpillar. And, you know, Caterpillar is a great company. It has very large profits. Yet, you know, to remain competitive, it's created a second wage tier.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one worker I write about, John Arnold, was making, you know, $14, $15 an hour, and that's the maximum he could earn, while his father, who's in the higher wage tier, and workers he worked next to make 20, 30, 40% higher than he does. And they feel confusion. They feel anger. They feel frustration. You know, they see, you know, Caterpillar makes about $35,000 in profits per worker, and Caterpillar says, well, we can't afford to pay you anymore. We have to remain competitive. And people like John Arnold and another worker I talk about, Scott Wilcox, and say, wait, you know, you should be able to pay us more than you're paying if you're making $35,000 profits per worker. And, you know, both of them, you know, John Arnold, Scott Wilcoxon, and Pura saying, you know, we need to get more education because that's one way to rise. You know, if all you have is a high school education, this economy has gotten tougher and tougher because more jobs, you know, more unskilled jobs are going overseas. So we're at a, you know, period in the nation's history where, you know, education, you know, is more important than ever.
Yeah. We're going to have to wrap up fairly soon now, but I'm wondering, given the big squeeze, does all this pressure, these pressures, contribute to the depth and breadth of an economic downturn when it occurs?
Yes. You know, I finished this book basically in December, January, before we even knew that there was a recession. And, you know, the thrust of the book is that in many ways things are tough for the nation's workers. It's, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just them suffering from wage stagnation. It's just them being hurt by higher health care premiums, but I try to explain that it's happening to lots of people. And things were tough at the end of last year, and now they're getting much tougher as we enter recession. You know, one other dismaying statistic is that we just came out of an economic recovery that began in November 2001, and economic growth and corporate profits did very well during that time. Yet the median income for the average household, for the typical household, actually went down during that economic recovery. So this might be the first time in American history when we're entering a recession after a so-called recovery, so-called expansion, mm-hmm. when income for the typical household went down. So that means, American households, American families, American workers are not really well prepared for this downturn, especially now with gas prices soaring and debt soaring. I'm worried that this is going to be a serious recession.
Yeah, and we haven't been doing very well at saving. We're really not well prepared at all. We have to wrap up now. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Celeste. Nice to be with you.
Stephen Greenhouse is the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. He's also the author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. The publisher is Knopf. You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit WILL.UIUC.EDU.
Today on A Moment of Science, what killed the dinosaurs?
Geez, again? I mean, haven't we done this one like 100 times? A giant meteor smashed into Earth and blocked out the sun, so the dinosaurs had nothing to eat and died.
But not all scientists agree with that theory. There's some evidence that a giant oil fire might have had something to do with the dinosaurs' demise.
Oh, okay, sorry.
No problem, because you're right. Scientists still agree that around 65 million years ago, a meteor or comet or something was the instigator. But it's not clear that the impact alone would have been enough to end the reign of the dinosaurs. So one theory is that the explosion started global forest fires. All that fire shot so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that the planet heated up like an oven and baked the dinos to death.
I've heard that theory, but the problem is there isn't as much charred plant debris as you'd expect if there really were such giant fires.
Right. So what sparked a new theory was the discovery of tiny carbon spheres at dozens of dinosaur dig sites around the world. The spheres are created from burning fossil fuels like oil. So maybe the meteor exploded in the midst of a huge oil field in the Gulf of Mexico. First, it would have vaporized the oil, then ignited it in the atmosphere, creating a huge skybound fireball. The combination of fire, soot, and global warming may have been enough to kill the dinosaurs.
Wow, and we think we've got an oil crisis.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear, with help from Simon Brassel in Geological Sciences. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. For podcasts, click on the podcast button. I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 1st of September, 2008. It's the birthday of one of the most popular pulp fiction writers in American history, Edgar Rice Burroughs, born in Chicago, 1875. He'd read Darwin's book, Descent of Man. He was fascinated by the idea that human beings were related to apes. And he got the idea of writing about a child from a noble family raised by apes. The result was Tarzan of the Apes, came out in 1912, and was first made into a movie in 1918. And it was on this day in 1939 that Germany invaded Poland, starting World War II. Prime Minister Chamberlain of Great Britain had tried to prevent a war by allowing Hitler to take part of Czechoslovakia. But Hitler took all of Czechoslovakia and then began to plan an invasion of Poland. He claimed the only part of Poland he wanted was the city of Danzig, which he said was rightfully German. And without making any formal declaration of war, he ordered the invasion on this day in 1939. Hitler's army was the most advanced in the world. He saw speed as the future of warfare, so he began the invasion with dive bombers, equipped with screaming sirens to terrify people on the ground. And then he sent in high-speed Panzer tanks, driving over fences and stone walls and destroying buildings. The Polish army was completely outmaneuvered. In one battle, a group of Polish cavalrymen rode out on horseback with lances and swords. They were slaughtered in minutes. The fighting lasted barely more than a month, and Hitler arrived in Warsaw for his victory parade, October the 5th, 1939. But back in Germany, people were not celebrating. The American journalist William Shirer was in Berlin as a correspondent for CBS Radio. He wrote in his diary that day, "It has been a lovely September day, the sun shining, the air balmy, the sort of day the Berliner loves to spend in the woods or on the lakes nearby. I walked the streets. On the faces of the people, astonishment, depression, stunned." And in New York City, the poet W.H. Auden wrote his famous poem, September 1, 1939, which begins, "I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade." Here's a poem for today, a poem by Meg Carney entitled Ticket. "I have a ticket in my pocket that will take me from Lynchburg to New York in 9 hours, from the Blue Ridge to Stuy Town, from blue jays wrangling over sunflower seeds to my alarm clock and startled pigeons. If I had a daughter, I'd take her with me. She'd sit by the window, wearing the blue dress with the stars and sickle moons, counting houses and cemeteries, watching the knotted rope of fence posts slip by while I sat beside her, pretending to read, but unable to stop studying her in disbelief. Her name would tell her that she's beautiful, Belle, or something strong, biblical, Sarah. She would tolerate the blue jay and weep for the pigeon. She would have all the music she wanted and always the seat by the window. If I had a daughter, she would know who her father is, and he would be home writing letters or playing the banjo, waiting for us, and I would be her mother. We'd have a dog, a mutt, a stray we took in from the rain one night in November, the only stray we ever had to take in one night in our cabin in the Catskills. It would be impossibly simple. 2 train tickets, a man, a dog waiting, and a girl with her nose pressed to the window." A poem, Ticket, by Meg Carney, used by permission of the poet here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. Publisher of Poetry Magazine, gift subscriptions are available at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Ella Shovanek and Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Your Labor Day forecast for Champaign-Urbana. For the rest of this afternoon, sunny, highs in the upper 80s, southeast winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. For tonight, mostly clear, lows in the mid-60s, light southeast winds. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 80s, south winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. And for tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 60s, west winds 5 to 10 miles an hour.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting the community to experience the opening wave of the 2008-2009 season, starting with the opening night party on Thursday, September 18th, featuring Grupo Fantasma. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM.